too. Link U.S. terrorists to international guerrilla groups. If there were international links to radical movements in the U.S., military intelligence encouraged this interaction. They need to prove communism is coming to America. Many police agents would welcome the arrival of a police state. They are creating the, quote, necessity to crack down on workers, the unemployed, and the hungry. International money is donated to right-wing radical groups. The CIA can also send unlimited funds abroad to be sent back here through, quote, radical connections. Instead of working to improve the quality of life in the United States, Roy Ash of the Office of Management and Budget works to reduce both opportunities and hope. When people become radicalized as a result, the finger will be pointed at, quote, communists and, quote, international influences, as though intolerable domestic conditions were not enough cause. Rather than face the realistic challenge, the usual pattern is to blame outside forces for unrest. If all the hungry and oppressed people in the world were to band together, it would not necessarily be a conspiracy. It would be caused by a common knowledge of who is depriving them of life. 3. Discredit communes. Why did a Supreme Court ruling recently come down against communes? Why have intelligence agencies backed up Rand Corporation studies and tried to smear communal living? Economics is always behind these acts and laws. By the media's association of the SLA with communal living, with its constant references to the communal Peking house, the suggestion is planted that group housing breeds violence. Communes are bad for business. 12 people living together can get along with one dishwasher instead of 6. Many young people have left their empty, sterile nuclear family homes and created a new kind of extended family, which provides them with friendship and support. This is seen as a threat to the status quo, with its inbred isolation and suspicion. The Sharon Tate, La Bianca massacres were the first organized assault by the military upon the hippie generation. The SLA is part of that pattern. Escalate domestic fear of Mao Zedong, brainwashing and communist-style indoctrination. Books by Chairman Mao were given to DeFries and the BCA. The Peking House commune diverted attention from the way clandestine agents were actually meeting. People living in the commune would be linked to communism by the presence of a few books about China. Symbionese, like Viet Cong, is an army coin name and policy. Criticism and self-criticism, words mouthed by Joseph Ramiro while in prison, would be linked to brainwashing techniques of the Orient. Leninist, Marxism, Stalinism are the whipping boys of the radical right. The détente does not exist for them. Gunnell's Chinese food stand suggests Asian infiltration in Gunnell's House of Spies. Every association of the SLA with China, no matter how weak, forced, or trivial, was exaggerated by the media. The mini-manual from Brazil was used to add to the suspicion of Maoist influence over the SLA. With this scanty ammunition, the Sacramento hearings on civil disorder and the Washington Internal Security Committee stepped up the communism scare. The best solution to this massive propaganda effort is to look very closely at the so-called, quote, experts, now writing articles and appearing on radio and TV talk shows. They are frequently connected to CIA front organizations. Check their occupations, their military service credentials and funding, and expose them for what they are, packagers of scare tactics and government propaganda. Number 5. Drum up support for the UCLA Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence. The proposed UCLA Center to Find Causes of Violence and the Behavior Research Center in Butner, North Carolina, are the two potentially most dangerous institutions planned or in operation in the U.S. today. Massive funding from the federal government, NASA, and intelligence agencies will escalate the transformation of human beings into zombies. Nazi doctors and well-trained American psychiatrists are already using electrode implants, transponders, powerful drugs, and similar devices on prisoners. Many of the current rash of, quote, senseless killings, massacres, and, quote, zombie-type murders are committed by individuals who have been in army hospitals, mental hospitals, or prison hospitals, where their heads have literally been taken over surgically to create terror in the community. Sirhan Sirhan was hypnotized to forget the persons who associated with and controlled him before he became the patsy in the Robert Kennedy murder. There is now a contract out to murder him in prison before the facts can be uncovered. The solution to these charges is not to shake your head and say, impossible. Ask prison inmates. They know it is true. Study the medical and military and prison history of every alleged murderer during the past 5 years. Investigate every hospital and every psychiatrist who treated them. A good starting point would be the case of Lawrence Kwong, who was programmed to murder a KGO radio broadcaster and then to kill himself in September 1973 in San Francisco. The day after the Marine-trained SWAT team of the LAPD murdered six SLA members in Los Angeles, the LA Times printed a letter to the editor. Somebody, disguised as a concerned citizen, begged UCLA to start, quote, finding the cause of violence. Letters to the editor are common CIA public relations plants to influence public opinion. Police did the killings, but they won't be studied. The victims of violence all their lives will be studied instead. 6. Discredit the poor. Rehearse for massive food handouts. Hand out contaminated food. The food handouts ordered by the SLA could serve several purposes. The poor were ridiculed, provoked to violence, and made to appear ungrateful. Cameras were on hand to photograph violence on the first day of the food distribution. Even worse than the image of violence and greed projected on the poor was the possibility that they were being poisoned. John F. Kennedy was outraged in 1962 when the CIA used chemical poisons to contaminate the sugar crop sent from Cuba to the USSR. He said, quote, this could be the beginning of chemical espionage. Controls over CIA activities died with John Kennedy. More sophisticated chemicals have been developed since then. At the same time the, quote, Feed the Poor program was going on in California, it was revealed that five giant chicken farmers in Mississippi had 22 million poisoned chickens. The birds had been fed chicken feed mysteriously contaminated with dieldrin, a deadly insecticide that can cause cancer. Some of those poisoned chickens had already been sent to school lunch programs for needy children in Detroit and Chicago. The five chicken growers asked $10 million from Congress as compensation for killing the remaining chickens. The New York Times suggested the high payment was in exchange for anti-impeachment votes from five Southern senators. Lost in the controversy was the question, were people being handed poisoned food? A solution is to give annual checkups to all the people in Detroit, Chicago, and the San Francisco Bay Area who received this, quote, free food. Governor Ronald Reagan publicly hoped that the recipients of the Hearst food giveaway program would suffer from, quote, an epidemic of botulism. In future years, will the people who ate this food suffer from an epidemic of cancer? Time will tell.
7. Creation of the SLA was intended to halt prison reform movements. Prison conspiracies are directly related to national conspiracies. Many political leaders have spent years in prison, the price they paid for understanding the causes of slavery and oppression. Potential leaders are nurtured inside the prison system. When the national policymakers sent down orders to destroy future black political leaders, violent assaults began taking place inside the prisons as well as on the streets. With the determination to transform prisoners into helpless, willless zombies, the fewer living witnesses, the better. If prison interviews and prison visitors are carefully controlled, the truth can never be told. That is why selected CIA and police agents were allowed to form the Black Cultural Association inside Vacaville Medical Facility. Every legitimate prison study group is infiltrated by the man, unquote, by CIA informers and agents. Prisoners are turned into informers against each other by the California Department of Corrections, the FBI, and CIA. All politically aware inmates must struggle for survival on a day-to-day basis. The solution is to demand that objective ombudsmen have free access to investigate prison conditions and to keep the public aware of what is happening inside the prison walls. The taxpayer provides the money to maintain these institutions, but prison authorities attack the society that supports them. Many prisoners have been offered parole or freedom by prison guards in return for murdering selected political prisoners or targets outside the prison walls. It is the prison system that is bringing violence into the streets, not the prisoners themselves. The recent Nixon-appointed Supreme Court ruling that news media may not interview specific prisoners is to exclude the public from what is taking place away from our sight. To make sure that prisoners are not coerced surgically into committing violent crimes, the medical records of every inmate should be available to a doctor of his choice. These records should also be made available for inspection by independent doctors chosen by the prisoner's lawyer, or objective investigative teams. 8. Escalation of race war. SLA members kept black makeup for murders and violence. Why did blacks get the credit for crimes they didn't do? Were the Zebra murders in San Francisco preceding the Hearst kidnapping conducted by many white men with black faces? Hit lists of Black Panthers and civil rights leaders among SLA possessions prove there is a determination to kill black leaders across the country. The cover story is that black militants want to kill false black leaders, unquote. But it is not the blacks who want their leaders dead. It is right-wing conspirators who wish to destroy black political leadership. The Nazi Party, KKK, States' Rights Party, and Minutemen seek a race war. Howard Hughes, IT&T, and other equally racist conglomerates send orders down the chain of command. Republican leaders, including the Attorney General, assure the assassins that they will never be discovered or prosecuted. The White House and the National Security Council worked with these extremist groups in the assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. They are also behind the Sinhalese Liberation Army. It is one thing to hate blacks and want a race war. It is quite another thing to receive funding and legal protection from the White House to promote genocide. The stopping of black males in San Francisco during the recent hunt for the zebra killers could lead to future card identifications, and apartheid. The zebra murders and Hearst kidnappings were synchronized and timed in an exact order. The solution is to investigate and prosecute the first-level agents. Make sure they are sentenced to life in prison for their crimes. When they are convicted, like the persons who were involved with the murder of labor leader Joseph Yablonsky, they will reveal who paid for the murders, then the masterminds can be prosecuted. 9. SLA links would discredit all radical movements and groups and tend to identify them with acts of violence. During the 1960s, agents infiltrated the anti-war movement. They also broke up rock concerts that were not political. 28 or more Black Panthers were murdered. Students were shot by National Guardsmen and local police who were following orders. The murderers were legally protected by grand juries and the Justice Department. SLA members infiltrated radical groups that are targets of the Attorney General and the FBI. These target groups include the United Farm Workers, the Women's Movement, the prison's Black Guerrilla Family, Vince Ramos, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, Winter Soldiers Organization, and Chino Defense Fund. The leadership of a wide variety of organizations, the Indian Movement, Gay Liberation, Nairobi College in East Palo Alto, Glide Memorial Church, the Black Teachers Caucus, the National Welfare Rights Organization, Third World Women's Alliance, United Prisoners Union, all were named by the SLA. In effect, they were targeted. FM radio stations, the underground press, and people's news services were specifically asked to observe and participate in the food distribution programs and to relay messages. They will feel repression soon. The same gesture of good faith, unquote, communique that identified radical groups as the SLA's instructors, also named Safeway and Mayfair as possible food distribution centers. Would reform workers with the United Farm Workers make the UFW's archenemy Safeway the headquarters for a free food program? Every communique sent out by the SLA revealed that this was an intelligence operation. The communiques also listed the groups targeted for the most infiltration and hassling during the coming year. Roadblocks have been set up to stop and search hippies across the country. 10,000 young people were stopped and searched in the 3 weeks following the shootout in Los Angeles. SLA sightings, like UFOs, can continue indefinitely. The Harrises can keep Patty in a CIA safe house for the summer, grooming her for her next hair-raising escapade while long-haired males and females with hair, eyes, and skin of all colors are stopped, searched, questioned, hassled, and busted. 10. Increase public and private security guards and police forces. On February 22, 1974, private security forces protected golfers at the Jackie Gleason Classic tournament as a reaction to the recent wave of kidnappings. Some typical news headlines. Executives rush for protection. Kidnap scare. The bodyguard business is booming. Colleges step up campus security. Bodyguards are ordered for legislators. Firms buying kidnap insurance. Mrs. Clark Gable tells how her son was almost kidnapped 14 years ago. Onassis family increases security. After Patty Hearst's kidnap and a few other kidnappings, the media escalated the hysteria and created whole new industries. There is profit in creating kidnap scares. There was also profit in offering protection.
Number 11. You too can become an informer. Watch for Patty. Turn the SLA in. The FBI was pictured as inept in the Hearst kidnapping. They asked us to help them find the SLA. That's not the way they did it on the old Jack Webb TV show.
Doctors were officially requested to notify the FBI if any of their patients fit the medical descriptions of SLA members. Neighbors were asked to sharpen their eyes, play detective, and report any of their neighbors living in groups who might be the SLA. Some, quote, suspicious signs would be that the group would be quiet, inconspicuous, and inoffensive. How suspicious can you get? We were supposed to get involved with the numerous reported SLA sightings, just as the Nazis noisily hunted the Jews from people's homes in Germany. The policies initiated in this domestic warfare are far more dangerous to our society than the six SLA members cremated in Los Angeles. 12. Instigate new laws and harsh legislation against kidnapping. Kidnapping is a terrifying experience. It can't be justified. Starvation and unemployment are also terrifying to people with no opportunity to provide for their basic needs. Punishment with laws, isolated dungeons, and more prisons will not solve social and economic problems, such as tremendous inequalities in the distribution of wealth. Kidnapping laws will not serve as effective controls any more than death penalty laws have served to prevent murders. Corporations want to protect their employees, and heads of firms want to protect their lives. Lawmakers oblige. Because of the CIA-SLA, new laws will be passed. It is a pitiful commentary on how inadequate our solutions are to the obvious problems all around us. Number 13. Christ and Christians versus radicals and terrorists. Christianity, the family, and God are fighting for survival today. Social change and radical politics are always associated with the Antichrist. Colston Westbrook received his CIA training at the Inter-Christian University in Tokyo. Wes Davis, the authority in communism and the evils of Asian Antichrist politics, is linked to World Humanity Against Totalitarianism, a Christian organization that could be another CIA front. Senator Jay Harmer, candidate for lieutenant governor in California, described the SLA terrorists as, quote, directed in their scheme against the will of God and the plan of Christ for the salvation of mankind, unquote. CIA agent William Buckley criticized Randolph Hearst's attempts to communicate with the terrorists. He felt that Patty should be sacrificed, quote, in the name of Christ, rather than placate the commies. The Nazi Party from Germany emerged openly in Chile after Allende was murdered. They blamed Jews for the radical politics in Chile. Obvious economic inequalities in Chile are ignored. The Nazi Party is visibly rampant in the San Francisco Bay Area. They were involved in the Foster murder. Several Nazi Party members work for the San Francisco Police Department. One keeps his Nazi uniform stored in a police locker between meetings. Following the scare tactics of kidnappings and bombings by police provocateurs, radical right-wing Christians will emerge to compare this violence to the godlessness of the Russians and Chinese. The bad guys will be labeled Antichrist, and the good guys will be Christians. 14. Discredit the FBI and make military intelligence agencies and the CIA seem necessary for routine police and investigative work. The FBI began to be publicly embarrassed and exposed during the last few years before J. Edgar Hoover died. The reason the FBI was made to appear so inept in the Hearst kidnapping is that the CIA and military intelligence agents wanted them to appear lost and bumbling. When the SLA was lured to Los Angeles, they were murdered by the Marine-trained SWAT team. The FBI contributed the incendiary bombs that set the house on fire, but the, quote, weakness of the FBI provides the CIA with an excuse for domestic police support. The Tom Charles Houston plan revealed how the military and intelligence could work with local police departments. For all practical purposes, the FBI is now combined with U.S. intelligence networks. 15. Set up martial law and a police state, keep power in the hands of the military and intelligence agents. Provisions will always be available to cancel any future elections or to rig national elections. The selection of candidates for 1972 was manipulated. 1968 required a murder to eliminate a candidate. Watergate hearings by the Senate and Special Prosecutor Leon Jaworski were not about to expose the depth of political corruption or the CIA military hold over the White House and themselves. The military controls the clandestine agents, political assassins, and potential kidnappers necessary to escalate violence. Massive uses of nerve gas or other planned tragedies can occur disguised as natural catastrophes. Vice President Gerald Ford's moving into the Navy compound, Admiral Ford, is consistent with a military takeover. Ford was a secret team member of the Warren Commission. This is a visible reminder of our monarchy, his enclosure surrounded by Navy intelligence. CIA Director Colby helped rig elections in Vietnam. We did well with these tricks while he was away. Imagine how much easier it will be to deceive with his talents as chief of all U.S. intelligence.
Well, that concludes the section of Mae Brussels' Realist article. Again, Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped? Realist Summer of 1974, that we're going to be reading to you on this broadcast. Again, I think not only does Mae's work speak for itself, including a lot of interpolative discussion, but, there isn't a heck of a lot to say that Mae hasn't already said about in that article about the SLA, why it was created, and so forth. It obviously has sprung from the same intelligence and police milieu that the criminal conspiracy section was involved with, and that the Squad 19 that hatched the Squad 19 conspiracy and was at one with that very same conspiracy. Now, the significance in dealing with Ronald Reagan's administration in California and the terrorist incidents that were generated by the police and intelligence establishments during that period is that many of the key players are now alive and well and operating on the national scene. Again, the criminal conspiracy section, quite obviously the SLA, were basically police intelligence operations, police-intelligence operations run in the state of California for the purpose of generating political reaction in a more repressive society, discrediting various political activists that the government wished to discredit. But it was basically that those operations were part of a national operation. As we saw with regard to the criminal conspiracy section, they were operating with FBI and CIA in the Squad 19 conspiracy or elements thereof, and obviously the Symbionese Liberation Army was part of what one might call a nationwide terrorist blitz. Well, terrorism has been very much in the focus since Ronald Reagan assumed the presidency, and not only, of course, is Ronald Reagan the governor of the state at the time all of this went down, President of the United States, but he has taken many of what some journalists refer to as the California Mafia along with him. One of the key people to keep in mind in relation to this whole terrorist blitz which befell California under Reagan is Ed Meese. Of course, now he's Attorney General of the United States. He was formerly District Attorney of Alameda County, where a lot of these incidents occurred, and under Ronald Reagan, he was the chief legal advisor to Ronald Reagan. And as indicated among the many reasons for creating the SLA and as indicated for the reason for the Squad 19 conspiracy, there is a move afoot among large elements of not only the police, but particularly the police who act at the behest of the national security establishment to create martial law, to create a police state. And one of the key things to note in connection with the possible creation of a police state with regard to Ed Meese, is something called the Garden Plot. A column appeared in the Oakland Tribune in 1984, which was authored by Ron Ridenhour, last name R-I-D-E-N-H-O-U-R. Ron served with Mae Brussels on the Citizens Research and Investigation Committee, and he wrote a long column about the Garden Plot and Ed Meese's role in it. The Garden Plot basically was a combined federal and state plan to create martial law and use the army and military in an extensive domestic espionage program. And we're going to read that article, too. This is from the Oakland Tribune, or actually it's a guest column by Ron Ridenhour, again, who worked with Mae Brussels on the Citizens Research and Investigating Committee. The following article is from the Oakland Tribune of Monday, February 13th, 1984. It's by Ron Ridenhour, and it's headlined, or titled, Why Civil Libertarians Are Leery of Ed Meese, subheaded, The Story of Operation Garden Plot, The Government's Plan to Quell Political Dissent. Skipping down a couple of paragraphs into the article. The Senate confirmation hearings on Meese's nomination won't uncover the real extent of his authoritarian views unless they look into Reagan and Meese's involvement in a secret Pentagon domestic espionage program. If Congress has the courage to investigate the Reagan-Meese connection to Operation Garden Plot and the events of May 1970, it will become eminently clear that Edwin Meese has no business being Attorney General of the United States. Garden Plot is the direct connection linking Reagan and Meese to the bad old days of Nixon and the police state tactics of the intelligence community of the 60s and early 70s. Reagan and Meese are involved in it up to their necks. At a clandestine conference convened in Sacramento on May 27th and 28th, 1970, barely 4 weeks after the invasion of Cambodia touched off the domestic plan to break the back of America's anti-war movement, Ed Meese gave the keynote to 1,350 police, military, and intelligence officers from all over the country, heralding the success of the operation in California. Garden Plot was the military's piece of the domestic espionage and political suppression pie that Lyndon Johnson ordered cooked up after the 1967 Detroit riots. Within days of the riots, Johnson brought in the heads of the CIA, the FBI, and the Pentagon, and ordered them to put a halt to the spreading violence in America's streets. The FBI and the CIA rapidly expanded the already existing domestic spying programs Idaho's Democratic Senator Frank Church's investigation made famous in the mid-1970s, COINTELPRO, and CHAOS. Military planners, however, took a more systematic approach, appointing a special task force on civil disorders that worked hand-in-glove with the Kerner Commission, the Blue Ribbon Panel Johnson set up to analyze the causes of big city riots that began with Watts in 1965. The Pentagon's task force produced a report in early 1968 that called for a five-pronged program. It was called Operation Garden Plot, the National Master Plan for Civil Disturbance Control. The transcripts and the military command directives ordering and describing much of what follows were obtained through official sources in the archives of the California National Guard and from the Arizona National Guard through the Freedom of Information Act. Garden Plot, like CHAOS and COINTELPRO, called for a massive intelligence program and the use of informants and infiltrators to spy on anyone who had a political beef and organized to tell it. Beyond that, however, Garden Plot called for America's police, military, and intelligence forces to undertake a series of joint training exercises in preparation for any contingency, including guerrilla war. The training exercises were designed around contingency plans that were ultimately developed for every large city in the country. The exercises were implemented through the National Guard training programs and called for the secret participation of key officers from all law enforcement agencies in the area, key National Guard, regular military, and intelligence community officers based in the same area. Together they practiced implementing the Pentagon-prepared contingency plan, reacting to pre-scripted civil disturbance scenarios that were controlled by regular Army officers. Reacting to scenario development, the joint teams of cops, troops, and spooks practiced using the intelligence information provided by the political espionage networks to help quell civil disturbances. The contingency plan invariably moved from some minor incident through a steadily escalating series of confrontations between police or soldiers and political demonstrators or racial antagonists until a declaration of martial rule was issued and the military stepped in and assumed control. Let me repeat that last sentence. The contingency plan invariably moved from some minor incident through a steadily escalating series of confrontations between police or soldiers and political demonstrators or racial antagonists until a declaration of martial rule was issued and the military stepped in and assumed control. California, under the Reagan gubernatorial administration, was one of the most enthusiastic participants in Garden Plot's preparations. When one of the main thrusts of the program called for the establishment of special training schools to teach Garden Plot participants the fine points of disorder management, unquote, as the umbrella doctrine of the program came to be known, Reagan hired the man who set up the Army's model program at Fort Gordon, Georgia, to put together its mirror image at San Luis Obispo. During the first 2 years of Garden Plot's annual joint training exercises, the scenarios were built around racial conflict. But when garden plotters across the country began their exercises in January of 1970, the contingency plans had taken on a new focus. Between January and mid-April of that year, Garden Plot's players began to practice doing battle with enormous crowds who, according to the new scenarios, would pour into the streets in spontaneous protest of a major foreign policy decision by the president. On April 30th, 1970, 2 weeks after the last of these Garden Plot war games had been played, Richard Nixon announced the invasion of Cambodia. The next day, massive demonstrations against the move began to take shape all over America. When they did, the demonstrators were quickly met by well-organized phalanxes of police and National Guardsmen who attacked them as if they were working from a plan. On May 26th, a Friday, the police, military, and intelligence community leaders of California's Garden Plotters began to congregate in Sacramento to trade war stories and celebrate their victory. Although some minor skirmishes continued to be fought through the end of the month, the anti-war and civil rights movements, except for a small hardcore of committed activists, were effectively over. During the 2 days of the conference in Sacramento, speaker after speaker came to the podium to crow of their victories and brag about their techniques. The transcripts of those speeches read like a primer on how to systematically emasculate the political liberties guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. Or should it reads primer, actually. Speakers were police commanders and intelligence officers, National Guard and regular army generals, district attorneys, and the executive secretary to the governor, Ed Meese. People in the streets were referred to as revolutionaries, radicals, guerrillas, enemies of society, vandals, Visigoths, VC kooks. The list goes on and on. Free speech, civil rights, the right to assemble, and a list of other political freedoms guaranteed under the Bill of Rights were characterized by speaker after speaker as simple ploys used by the revolutionaries, unquote, to attack the sanctity of the state. Few speakers failed to mention the role and operational importance of maintaining the best possible intelligence network, pointing repeatedly to the critical link political espionage played in drumming up successful felony prosecutions against people who took active leadership roles in activist organizations. Ed Meese was the luncheon speaker on May 27th. He came, he assured his listeners, as Ronald Reagan's personal emissary. He mentioned Nixon's name twice, saying that Nixon and Reagan had spoken on the day 3 weeks earlier when four people were shot to death by Ohio National Guardsmen at Kent State. He added later that Nixon was as concerned with the confrontation between those gathered there and the revolutionaries as he was with the war in Vietnam. Meese called the anti-war protest a form of guerrilla war, commending the various tactics and intelligence operations earlier speakers had detailed, assuring his audience that they had the administration's full support. Quote, "This is an ongoing effort," unquote, he told them at one point in his 5,000-word speech, "something that, despite resistance, despite the activities of some who state that this is overreacting, this is an operation, this is an exercise, this is an objective which is going forward because in the long run I think it is the only way that we will be able to prevail," unquote. Meese goes on to say that what the garden plotters had done so far, while a good beginning, is only the beginning. He calls for a long-range plan that will include better coordinated, more extensive political intelligence gathering, more concerted action to find ways to, quote, "successfully prosecute those who are raging in the conflict on our campuses and in the streets," unquote, including ways to get the courts to, quote, "recognize their responsibility in terms of appropriate sentencing to make sure that these people who have been convicted of revolutionary activity, of violation of the penal code, are given punishments, penalties that are consistent with the degree of public disorder and inconvenience which these people have caused." So, again, it's an interesting and horrifying scenario, one which we've seen in the past with regard to the Vietnam War in California, and obviously that dovetails very neatly with the provocations such as Squad 19 and the SLA conspiracy, which were intended to provoke exactly that kind of a police state. And again, the significance for our present purpose is that the people who are operating in California as the California connection for this national operation are now running things from Washington. Ed Meese is one, and he's not the only one.
And yes, it couldn't help but be apparent, Ed Meese's reference in that, as in a speech during 1972, the long-term plans and doing even better in the long run. And indeed, that's what we're looking at. And as Dave mentioned, Ed Meese is now Attorney General of the United States, which as far as law enforcement and preventing the expression of the First Amendment and things like that, you can't be in a much better position for that. One of the other people who has a large amount of influence on how freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, etc., are in this country is, of course, the Chief Justice of the United States. We mentioned earlier Robert Mardian working in the Justice Department during the Nixon administration, a man working under Robert Mardian and, in fact, doing perhaps much of the, quote, brain work for Mardian and through Mardian for John Mitchell, Nixon's Attorney General, is a man by the name of William Rehnquist, Rehnquist, and I'm sure that name is very familiar to most of you because, of course, he has, for the past 13 years or so, been on the Supreme Court, and now he has been nominated for the post of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court by Ronald Reagan. Rehnquist, of course, has long been the most conservative member of the Supreme Court. He is famous for his 1-8 dissents against popular court decisions. Rehnquist has always been a strong supporter of the state versus the individual to almost absurd extremes. And now he has been nominated by Ronald Reagan as Chief Justice. Bear in mind also, as we're going to see from this short article, which we're going to finish up our program tonight, that William Rehnquist since early on in his career, has been very much also interested in the concept of infiltrating the military and intelligence into daily life, into police action, with the objective in mind of keeping the populace down. And we're going to read a short article here from San Francisco Chronicle for Friday, August 22nd, 1986. The headline is, Rehnquist Can't Recall Writing Surveillance Memo. Dateline Washington. It's an AP Wire story. Chief Justice-designate William Rehnquist said he has, quote, no recollection of drafting a Justice Department memo in 1969 in which he proposed army surveillance of civilian anti-war protesters. Rehnquist also said he could not recall, quote, any participation in formulating policy on use of the army to conduct surveillance or collect intelligence on civilians. Rehnquist's comments were given in writing to Senator Charles Mathias, a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Mathias, a Republican from Maryland, was in the majority in the panel's vote to recommend Rehnquist's confirmation by the full Senate. The memo, which included a detailed plan for use of the military in quelling a civil disturbance, could have a bearing on the continuing battle by Senate liberals to derail Rehnquist's nomination. One of the major issues has been Rehnquist's failure to disqualify himself in 1972 as a Supreme Court Associate Justice from a legal challenge to the surveillance program. Rehnquist told senators during his confirmation hearings that he stayed on the case, casting a crucial vote in the 5-4 decision against the protesters, because he had little knowledge beforehand of the facts in dispute. The draft memo was among internal Justice Department documents written by Rehnquist and given the committee at the request of Democratic senators. Democratic Judiciary Committee staff members learned that the memo had been disclosed in 1974 during Senate testimony by Robert Jordan, former General Counsel of the Army. Jordan had testified, quote, I find in the files a March 25, 1969 memorandum from Bill Rehnquist, Assistant Attorney General, Office of Legal Counsel, to the Attorney General, and the Deputy Attorney General. This represents the first formal justice draft of the civil disturbance plan intended for the President's approval, unquote. In his letter to Mathias, Rehnquist said, quote, I have no recollection of my personal role in the preparation of this document. From the text of the transmittal memo, I assume that the plan was primarily drafted by staff members in my office and in the office of the General Counsel of the Army and reviewed by me, unquote. And the article goes on to mention that the Army and all the people involved at the time refute Rehnquist's assertion that he was that the Army was involved in the drafting of it, or that it was his staff or things of that nature, that it was in fact Rehnquist himself who drafted that. It was Rehnquist himself who then turned around and lied to be able to sit in and cast the deciding vote on that particular deliberation, a vote that went against the protesters, needless to say. And it is William Rehnquist who has lied about it several times since then, and it is William Rehnquist, staunch foe of civil liberties, who is most likely going to be our next Chief Justice of the United States, to work in tandem with Ed Meese, staunch foe of civil liberties and longtime advocate of the use of military and intelligence against civilians whose only crime is that they disagree with their government. It's Ed Meese and William Rehnquist who are going to most likely be working together in the next few years to make sure that you and I get just what we deserve.
What will be interesting to see, again, the reason we're going into this whole tangle of provocations and police and intelligence operations in California under Reagan, is there's the old saying on the street, what goes around comes around. It'll be interesting to see to what extent the national situation within a couple of years reflects the sort of thing we saw in California under Ronald Reagan and Ed Meese, and whether or not the criminal conspiracy section, Squad 19, the SLA, are patterns which are to repeat themselves in a larger national format. Well, stay tuned. We will find out.
Indeed. And with that, we are going to wrap up Radio Free America for this evening. As mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast long ago, this is a pre-recorded broadcast. It is going to be aired on the date you are listening to it, and then perhaps subsequently, but it is being done in the studio this evening. Those of you who are interested in obtaining Radio Free America broadcast, we do have a tape service that makes this available. The tape service's name is DAVCOR, and in just a moment I'm going to let Dave give you the address. Anything else we need to mention before we go? Oh, yes, Mae Brussel, who was quoted at great length tonight. Of course, we read most of the broadcast was taken up with reading a segment of May's article published in the summer 1974, Realist. Mae Brussell is heard on the station on which this broadcast is originally being aired, KFJC in Los Altos Hills, Thursday nights at 9 p.m. and also Sunday mornings at 9 p.m. So Mae Brussell's World Watchers International can be heard on this station.
Now, all of our archive shows, The Guns of November, the four-part series about the assassination of President Kennedy, all 23 Radio Free America shows, plus other tapes, are available from a tape duplication service called DAVCORE. The last name is D-A-V as in Victor, K-O-R-E. DAVCORE is located at Suite 1300D, as in DAVCORE, Space Park Way, three words just like it sounds, Space Park Way. That's in Mountain View, California. Zip code 94043. The phone number is area code 415-969-3030. Write or phone to the attention of Paul. The address once again, DAVCORE, Suite 1300D, Space Parkway, Mountain View, California, 94043. Phone 415-969-3030.
And with that, we are going to bid you adieu for this evening. We will be back, of course, on this station again, KFJC.
We should probably add, though, that neither NIP nor myself nor this station makes a dime off of that, but it is totally nonprofit.
Absolutely. On this station on which the broadcast is originally aired, KFJC, One Step Beyond, with Dave Emery and myself, NIP Tuck, can be heard Sundays from 8 to 11 p.m., and as we mentioned before, Mae Brussell's World Watchers International also aired Thursday, 9 p.m., Sunday, 9 a.m. on this station. And that's going to do it. We'll be back next month with another Radio Free America. Thank you so much for joining us. For Dave Emery, this is NIP Tuck saying good night and thank you.